Welcome to a very possessed episode of the Retro Rankings podcast. It is the month of October, and so therefore the two episodes this month will be a little bit scarier than a typical Retro Rankings podcast episode is. I'm Paul of Potation Rotation fame, and today, let me tell you what I'm drinking. I am drinking the Mountain Dew Voodoo 3, very appropriate for this time of year. It's probably the best Voodoo that they've put out. If you're familiar with the Voodoo series, third consecutive year, it's always a mystery flavor. It's always some kind of fruity candy flavor. So, but it's amazing how different they all are. This one is quite literally the best that they've released so far, in my opinion. So that was a creepy intro there. He had Reagan from the Exorcist kind of taking control of things, and some poor bitch probably getting gutted. Anyway, so as I had stated earlier, I was going to do kind of a story time with Paul every 10th episode, just so you all can get to know your host. Some stories might be video game related, some might not. And I thought, how appropriate that the first episode like this falls in the month of October. So I thought I'd give you some ghost stories, tell you my paranormal past, if you will. That's what we're going to talk about today. But real quick, let's just get into some video game stuff. It's funny. I've never, well, first of all, well, let me tell you something. So Metroid Dread just hit, right? Just dropped. And that is something that I am enjoying. However, I just wanted to let you know a little secret. So my history with Metroid is that it's a top 10 Nintendo franchise for me, easy. But I've played Prime. I've never played the sequels to Prime. And I've played all the other Metroid games. I have yet to actually beat the original Metroid. I'm pretty sure I recall as a child sitting around and watching somebody beat it, or maybe I did beat it, but I can guarantee you it wasn't legitimate. I guarantee you it was like a Game Genie or something like that. Never played Fusion. I should probably have played that by now, but I did not. All the other ones I've played and I finished. In regards to Super Metroid, that is one that I most definitely can tell you that even though I finished it, I never finished it cleanly. There was some help. I'm pretty sure that it was in some form or another a Game Genie type of situation. The problem with me in that game was that there was a lot of times where I just got frustrated. I got like lost. I thought I'd hit dead ends. Couldn't figure out where to go next. Would keep going back and forth and all around whatever areas of the map I had unlocked and just running around in circles, getting me nowhere, and I would just stop playing the game, and I would literally not play it for years, and then I'd try again. And it wasn't always, like, the same, like, area or whatever that I'd, like, just get stumped with. So, just a few weeks ago, I actually picked it back up, and I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to legitimately finish this game without the help of any kind of codes or cheating or save states, anything like that. Just, I'm going to get through it. I'm going to get through it. And I did. And I'm super proud of myself at the ripe young age of 44, finally finishing Super Metroid. That is a deep, dark secret that I have kept with me all these years since it came out, that I never really finished it legitimately. So now I did. I can say I did. I need to play Fusion. I know. I need to play Fusion. I heard it's a good game. Haven't played it yet. So, but Metroid Dread, I got my copy actually from Japan, and the reason why is because they bundled it, a collector's edition, along with the Amiibo that was sold out. When that Amiibo went on sale, I was in a meeting. So when the pre-orders happened, and by the time I got out of the meeting, pre-orders were done. So good old Amazon.jp had a bundle. That's where I got mine from. And you know, they ship stuff from there pretty fast. I don't know if you've ever ordered anything from Amazon Japan. There's a lot of times where I've gotten special Amiibos, Japan-only Amiibos, hard-to-find Amiibos. That's most of where my Amazon Japan shopping lies. Actually, it's almost all video games or video game-related items I get from there. I don't shop for anything else from there. So, and what's kind of cool is I got points. So every time you buy from Amazon Japan, you accrue these points, and you can use them towards money off future purchases. So there's that. There's my video game talk for the day. But let's get into this. This really isn't going to have a format. These episodes, every 10 episodes, aren't going to have a format. I was thinking of doing what was going to be called 10 on 10, and that's what every of these episodes would be called, the 10 on 10, and then whatever the subject matter would be. But that means I would have to do from 7 to 10. I don't want to do rankings. I don't want to do rankings on these episodes. I'm just going to talk, but I'm going to tell you about my paranormal background. So here we go. Some ghost story time from Poltergeist Paul, Retro Rankings Podcast. I'm not the best storyteller. When my current employer wanted to, they send out these company-wide emails for new hires to let everybody know that there's a new team member. Got some pictures, a little bit of a bio. One of the questions is, let us know something about yourself that, you know, nobody really knows. Something that's kind of a quirk, something that's kind of unique. And I said that I used to be a paranormal investigator, and that I was actually on television once to actually give one of my stories. And it gets attention. People genuinely want to know, like, holy shit, like, so tell me some ghost stories, you know? And I tell them the best that I can, you know. I'm not the best storyteller. I think there's a little bit of more. I think I'm a little bit humble in my storytelling. Like, I could embellish a little. I could be a little bit dramatic, you know. But I'm not, you know. And it's a part of me. It's a part of my history that I really should be proud that I did, that I accomplished. I actually had a goal. I have a lot of goals in what I do, and most of the things fall short of those goals. This was something that I did that actually I had a goal in mind, and I set out for it, and I reached it in like about 5 years. So I need to be proud of it. There was a period of time where I was sick of talking about it. I was sick of thinking about it. I wanted to remove myself from that part of my life because there was some times where it became tainted. But it really starts all the way back to when I was a child. And there's certain terms, some more universally accepted terms for this, like some people might say that I would be psychic or have a sixth sense, so to speak. But from a pretty young age, I kind of felt like I was connected to the other side. I would label myself as just sensitive. That's just the word that I've always used. I could walk through a cemetery, which I chose to do growing up in one area where I lived, to and fro school. There was a cemetery. And on a good day, when the cemetery felt calm to me, I would walk through it. But every now and then, I could approach that cemetery and feel something heavy, feel something out of place. And I didn't quite understand it. And it told me to stay out, like, don't walk through here. And I wouldn't. And I look back and it's more or less like, I think there might have been something angry there, something, I wouldn't go as far as saying sinister, not scary, but just something that was just like, you know what, don't be walking over our graves today, you know, like just walk on the side of the road or take the railroad tracks. There were some railroad tracks back there too. Like, just don't come through here today. And I look back and I'm thinking, I think it was like a mutual respect type thing. Like, you know, yeah, sometimes you can come through here and be a kid and do what you do and read the headstones and, you know, and think about the person's life that once had lived. And then there's going to be days where it's like, we don't want you to do that. Don't do it. And I understood. I also felt things and seen things. I don't tell a lot of people. I might have told my parents. I think it got to a point where at one point, I know I definitely told my parents something, but I was always seeing things. Things were coming to me. Things were visiting me. And it got to a point where when I was a teenager and I was in high school, I saw something in our house. And none of our houses were haunted. It was me. I was haunted, so to speak. And I saw something floating like above my head. I was in the bathroom. The house was pretty much dark. It was at night. Came out of the bathroom, opened up the door. I was about to go downstairs. And something was just like hanging there. And I'm like, at this point, I'm like, you know, what do you want? Like, I didn't know what anything wanted. I wasn't really communicating with anything. I couldn't receive messages. I didn't know what the fuck was going on. Was I scared? A little bit. You know, anytime these things happen, I was conjuring things up with Ouija boards. That really could have started it. The Ouija board thing was right around the time when I was going to a school with a cemetery in between my house and the school. My use of Ouija boards. That could have opened it up. That could have opened up the quote-unquote portal, as they would call it, the gate. The gate to the other side for me. But I'm pretty sure I told my parents something at some point, and I think it was when I saw something hovering above me when I was going down from the second floor to the first floor of the house. And I just like walked under it and looked up at it and kept eye contact with it. And I got to the bottom of the stairs and, you know, I fully turned around at that point. Otherwise, I'd be pulling a Reagan from The Exorcist and my head would be completely twisted back if I hadn't. And just looked at it until it went away, and it went away. It just like dissipated. And I started having, especially around the time I was a teenager into probably, I was like about 22 when it stopped. I'd get like these, I thought they were dreams, but I realized that they weren't, with things trying to give me messages coming to me. And unsure still what these things were trying to, these beings, if you will, these ghosts were trying to tell me. One was actually really quite creepy, almost like a no-face Slender Man, lanky finger, you know, type of thing that came to me once. I realized these weren't dreams when, you know, because you wake up from a dream and your eyes need to adjust, right? And you need to like sit there and think, oh, yeah, no, that was just a dream. I was just asleep. Like that didn't happen. Okay, boy, that felt so real. But, you know, no, it was just a dream. Eventually, I became so aware of what was going on that I'd realize that when this visitation was over, I was awake. It wasn't a dream. There was no, like, when it was done, and I would, like, get up and go get a glass of water or, you know, just kind of, you know, shake it off, so to speak. My eyes were already adjusted. I could see in the dark just fine because they had always been open. There was no feeling that I had just woken up. After I realized that, after I realized these aren't dreams, like this is like legit happening to me, like not frequently, like maybe like 2-3 times a year at most for 6 years. Some people don't know that I've talked to don't even know the extent of that's how often that this happened. They started to get a little bit scarier towards the end, like the lanky, Slenderman-ish type of guy. I have no idea what that was. I have no idea what he was trying to tell me. I would see him standing sideways, and then he'd turn and look at me with his blank face. There's no face. And he'd start shaking his head and then put up his finger and start waving his finger like, no, 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 or something. And like those were towards the end of all that. That was towards my realization that these weren't dreams. And that's when they stopped. And I started to try to research things. Now, the other thing that was pretty big that happened, and it was my freshman year of high school. Like I was 14-ish, something like that. It could have been just the connection I had with my grandfather, my mom's father, being his first grandchild and him being my favorite grandpa. My other grandfather died when I was 6. So I barely have memories of him, just very, very, very few. So therefore, you know, you got another, you know, this grandpa on my mom's side had another 8-9 years on him. So it could have been that, that connection that, he, you know, and he had been in a hospital before. He's had illnesses before that weren't, that were a non-issue, I guess you could say. For me, like I didn't think much of them, but this week that he fell ill, I remember seeing him the weekend before, and my mom was going to take him shopping, and they usually would drop me off someplace back then, like a Chuck E. Cheese or a movie theater or some stores, and I kind of just did my own thing. And then I'd either walk back to my grandparents' house or they'd pick me up or whatever. My mom, that weekend after all was said and done, actually came and picked me up after she had already dropped my grandpa off. So that was the last time that I saw my grandpa that day was on a shopping weekend, and they dropped me off to do my own thing. And he ended up in the hospital that week, and I knew something wasn't good about this one. Like, something was off. And a couple days into the hospital stay, I actually took it upon myself during lunch at school, to go to a payphone and call the hospital and ask for his room. And I spoke with him, and that was the last time I spoke with him. And he tried to assure me that everything was fine, that he'd be coming back home. And I knew that still something wasn't right. And 2 days later, I'm sitting in class, and it was a history class or a social studies class of some sort. And I don't know, sometime between 1 and 2 p.m. that afternoon, this feeling of loss, this feeling of instant grief, this feeling that something was just taken away from me, just came over me. It was a feeling of deep loss. It was like something cold had touched me briefly. Instant sadness. I had a couple more hours to go, and I had to get my ass home. I got my ass home pretty quick that afternoon. And walked in the house, and right away, I asked my dad what was going on. And he said, your mom's not home right now, but she's on her way back. Oh, on her way back. Now, my mom worked at night. So the fact that she had not gone to work and was on her way home from somewhere, my heart sunk. I just knew. Like, I knew. I didn't put it together when it happened sitting in class, but at that point, I mean, it was just more than a confirmation that I think, and I'm pretty sure that in some way, shape, or form, my grandfather came to me the moment he passed away to let me know he passed away, but I didn't know. Like, I didn't see him. It was just like some kind of feeling like, I'm here, I'm going to let you know I'm here in some odd way, I suppose, and that I'm going to be gone, you know? And so, yeah, sure as shit, my mom came home and she's like, get in the car, we need to go for a ride. And we went just halfway through town, pulled over, and she told me that my grandpa had passed away, you know, like at 1:30 or something that afternoon. And yeah, so there's that. Sensitive. Through all those things that have happened, that's where I get the word from, sensitive. I have been pretty good at picking up on things. I started to even branch out, if you will, right around the time that it all stopped, like when I was like I said, about 22, I started like giving people, I don't know what you would call them, like not psychic readings or anything like that, but like I would tell people when something bad was going to happen. I was like the bearer of bad news. I would be like, something's bad is going to happen, and you're going to have to prepare yourself for it. This is what's going to happen. It's going to happen, you know, here and there, and like, you know, be ready. And I think the four times that I did something like that, three of the times were like dead on accurate, and the fourth time it was like, it wasn't really accurate. It was not even really close to being right. But I went from like saying, oh, there's going to be like a car accident. And I told this girl that she was going to be in a car with somebody and that she was going to be driving. There was going to be a car accident that the girl I was talking to. And that weekend, she went out with her friend, but it was flipped. The friend was driving. So I don't know if like, this was like a thing where she was like, I'm not driving, you can drive, because Paul, or I don't know if she would have said, you know, I don't know what the situation was. I don't know how it went down. I don't know why she made the decision not to drive and have her friend drive. But there was still a car accident, but it was very minor. Like, they went up a curb and like hit a fire hydrant or something. And like, so minor damage that, yeah, obviously they could just still drive right off, you know, so it wasn't like bad and like nobody died. I don't remember how much information I gave them beforehand. I don't know how bad I made it seem. Some things were very vague, which is why one of them didn't turn out to be like really remotely close to being correct at all. As little as something like that, all the way to the other one was I told some guy that his aunt was going to die. And like, you need to go out and see your aunt. Like I said, your aunt's going to die. It's on your mom's side. This woman's on your mom's side. She lives nowhere like close to us, but not very far. But y'all need to like make a trip to see her because she's going to die. And he was like, holy shit, like my mom's sister. Yeah, she's got cancer and she lives in Madison. And okay. You know, so that weekend or something, they went to visit her. And then 2 days after coming back, she died. And I was like, so he actually, I remember this was at work. There's somebody I work with. These are all people that I worked with. And so I, that was like the big one. That was the big one. And, it got to the point where I was like, I was even like able to like get her name remotely close to what it was without ever knowing anything. I didn't even know his parents' name. I didn't know if he had any brothers, sisters. Like I didn't know this guy very well that I worked with, this kid. So, but that was like the big one. And he actually came in with his parents, then a few days later, and his parents like thanked me. Like, we don't know how you did that or how you knew, but it's almost like, you know, I mean, like she was waiting or something for them to come out and visit or something before passing away. So I was like, I don't know what I did or how I did it. It just happens. It just like, I would go into this, I wouldn't even say a trance, almost like when these things were coming to visit me and it almost felt like it was a dream, but it really wasn't a dream. That's kind of the same state. I guess it would be like a trance-like state, but I've never been in a trance before. I've never been in a situation where somebody goes, okay, I'm going to put you in a trance. And then I'm in a trance. And then as soon as I'm out, they're like, okay, you're in a trance and now you're out of it. Like, so I don't know what that is. So maybe it was, but yeah. So after that, it was like, tell me my future. Am I going to be rich? You know, and stuff like that. And I'm like, I don't do that. That's not what I do. Things come to me and tell me things. And I'm just starting to understand like how to do this and how to like talk to the other side and how to listen. And I don't know how I'm doing it. I don't know how I'm tuning into it. I don't know how this being sensitive thing works. I was just really starting to get to, but it got to the point where that was pretty scary. That whole thing, like even though I did good and I got thanked for it, to have something tell me to give a message to somebody else that somebody that they love is going to die, like that's pretty fucking heavy, you know? And I told myself, I'm done. Like I just said, whatever's going on, I'm done. Just be done with it. I'm done. And it pretty much cooled off. Like everything stopped. Like as soon as I said, I'm done, it stopped. So fast forward now to about 2008. So we were talking, this was probably 8 years prior. Eight years prior, all that when it stopped. So fast forward to 2008. And I'm just about to hit 30. Or I was 30. I was 31, 32. I was about 30. But like I said, it was about 8 years after I said, this needs to end. And I was clean for 8 years, clean, so to speak, of the paranormal for 8 years. There was still a fascination. I still would watch the ghost shit on TV, and I would still like have this almost like this odd connection to cemeteries. Like I still needed to go there, and I still needed to stroll around a random cemetery every now and then and find a plot that I could connect with, and then just stand there and like communicate in silence with whoever was buried there. It was like, it's like the weirdest thing that happened maybe like once or twice a year. I just randomly did that. But other than that, I like completely cut myself off and things stopped talking to me. I'm sure they're people. They've got to be people, right? Whether I can see them or not. My now ex-wife had some friends and they had started a ghost hunting group. And there was my, you know, then, I don't know if I was married to her yet or not. I don't think I was, but when we all met each other for the first time or something, yeah, we weren't married. So that was like about 2007. And my then soon-to-be ex-wife, she wanted me to like say something to them, like, oh, you know, like they're ghost hunters or whatever. Like, maybe you should like get in on that, because she knew my story. She, you know, I talked to her about that kind of stuff, and that one day out of nowhere, out of blue, I might tell her some bad news or something that hasn't happened yet. And that almost every relationship I ever would get into, I'd be like, I just say like, no Ouija boards, no Ouija boards. Don't ever suggest a Ouija board. Don't ever bring one out. Don't buy one. No Ouija boards. So you guys can sit there and think like, oh, Ouija board's just a fucking Milton Bradley game or something. But I'm telling you from my history, Ouija boards are no joke. So anyway, even the mass-produced Milton Bradley Ouija boards, no joke. So anyway, I kept my secret from these people. I said nothing. I didn't act interested whatsoever. There was no discussions. Like, they never like really talked to me about it or anything. So that was good, because there was nothing that I would have to talk about. But eventually, something came up. I think I was at their house or something, and their ghost hunting came up in conversation, some random conversation, and he was kind of showing me some stuff, or maybe like running by an EVP clip or something that he was proud of. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty cool. This is like the kind of stuff you see on TV nowadays, I guess, you know. And it, the conversation ended up going to my history of being sensitive. And it basically, it was, hey, we could use somebody like that on our team, just to like, you know, it basically, it was, you get these stories from people, right? Like, this is what's going on in my house. And you have to go in with an open mind, but you also have to go in and say, there's an explanation for everything. You even have to ask like some pretty deep personal questions of these people. Like, you know, what kind of medications are you on? Can I get the names of any and all medications that you're on? Are you lying to me? Are you sure there isn't any more? Are you doing any kind of drugs? You know, like, you've got to like really make sure that these people aren't nuts. You're basically asking them like a lot of questions. It's almost like applying for a job. You're having them fill out these questionnaires, and you got to hope and pray that they're not lying to you. So, because you want to believe them. And if they're clean and they seem sane, okay, well, then you got to believe them. But now you also have to try to go through a case and come back on the other end and say, well, here's the reasonable explanations for what you're experiencing. However, like I said, you got to be open-minded. So the initial aspect of him wanting me to join, and I was hesitant, I first said no, was that I could walk into a place and immediately know if it was clean or not. And even if it seemed clean coming in initially, that if there was something there that just I couldn't sense right away, that initially throughout an investigation, I could sense it, I could pinpoint it, I could lead everybody in the right direction, nobody's wasting their time, so to speak. I said no initially, but eventually I said yes. And I think it was because at that point, you know, I told them, I said, I kind of feel like it's an abuse of me. I didn't want, and I had been clean of this, like I said, for like a solid 8 years. And it was almost a relief. Those 8 years were almost a relief of things not coming to me and speaking to me and, you know, me not sensing some things that were as terrible as somebody dying, or as trivial as somebody jumping a curb and and hitting a fire hydrant at like 5 miles an hour or 10 miles an hour, however fast they were going. But I think I don't remember exactly what made me change my mind, what made me I just remember when I said okay, I took like a real deep breath. Like I took a real deep breath. I closed my eyes and I was like, okay, I'll do it. And I think it was mostly because I told myself that even in the worst situations, if I felt that, I wouldn't say abused anymore, like abused, used, like, yeah, I was invaluable to an extent, but almost like cheating. I don't know. It's hard to explain, really, but I felt like a circus sideshow freak. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's how I felt going into it, which is why I said no initially. And through whatever other discussions that were being had that led me up to begrudgingly agreeing to do it, I think I told myself that I'd be helping people. People are reaching out for help. People are reaching out not knowing what's going on. They're scared. Or maybe they're not scared and they're fine with whatever's going on, but they would still like to know what it is. And so I was like, you know what? I think that might be useful. It's almost like the going up to somebody and saying, you're going to be in a car accident, or you're going to die, or your dog's going to run away, which was the other one. The fourth one, I don't even remember what it was anymore because it wasn't even close to being correct. So I have no idea. And those four, by the way, happened over a period of 2 years. So it's not like it was all four were like in a week or something like that. So I told myself I'm going to be helping. And you know what? Maybe I'll find my own answers in doing this as well. Maybe I'll finally get to go to a place where maybe something is definitely there. And whatever's there can give me an answer. Like, whatever's there can be like, hey, like, I've been waiting for somebody like you to help me or something, you know, and then I'm helping them maybe as well, which I don't think I ever helped any kind of spirit in any case whatsoever. But yeah, so that's then where it started in 2008. And I did it for a solid 5 years. My last cases ended in 2012, and I had like 30 cases under my belt, including some speaking engagements, an appearance on the local news, an interview in a local paper, hauntedhouses.com, which used to be a thing. I don't know if it's a thing anymore. You guys can go check it out if you want. Did video interviews with me, along with some other people locally who also did the same thing. What else? Oh, and then I was on Bio's My Ghost Story caught on camera, which was really like the tail end of everything. It was like the thing that told me that I need to like stop doing what I'm doing. So I actually started in a cemetery. That was my first, down in Wadsworth, Illinois, just near Six Lakes Great America, actually, just a few miles from there. And started in a cemetery there. It was called Old St. Patrick's Cemetery, and it kind of had this Bloody Mary connection, which is just lore. I don't think that Bloody Mary actually originated near that cemetery, an old supposed farmhouse that's in the woods there. I think it's just lore. It's just a story. Regardless, it started in the cemetery, and it was, for the first time ever, I was in a cemetery where I was actually kind of scared because I didn't know what was going on. I'm actually out here like looking purposely for ghosts. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's so different. Like trying to capture something, so to speak, not in a ghost trap. This isn't Ghostbusters, but capture like on video or audio or just like, I hope I can see something with my own eyes type of a thing. But it was interesting. We got photographic evidence of a ghost that evening, and we actually heard with our own ears and got it on audio, a disembodied voice. And I actually was the first to hear it, and I stopped my friend at the time, who ran this group. I'm like, did you just hear some guy talking? You know, like, he's like, yeah, I heard that too. Like, I thought it was just me. I'm like, nope, heard it too. And so, yeah, that's what started. And the adrenaline, it went from the adrenaline you feel you get when you're kind of like scared, when you're uncertain, when there's an uncertainty to things and you don't know how things are going to go, to after hearing that, like I was almost relieved because somebody else heard it. Like, I thought it would have just been me with my history. But the fact that somebody else heard it, I'm like, okay, so you don't have to be sensitive. You don't have to be like me to experience things. Like, that is like a good answer. That's like a good thing for me. And it got exciting, and it just snowballed from there. So I was only with that group for probably a year and a half. As I come to find out, and as such a thing in that industry, if you want to call it that, there's a lot of fucking drama. A lot of fucking drama. There are people that will step on people to try to get ahead, to try to be the best in the field, to want, you know, they'll say like, we're only here to help. We do it for free. We don't want to be famous doing it, but they definitely want to be the number one most well-known ghost hunter or ghost hunting team in whatever region that you're in, which is pretty damn close to being you wanting exclusivity to things, to everything, to be, you know, the number one, you know, place that somebody calls or emails when they want help. And I was never about that. You know, part of that is me being humble, and part of it was me like being, I don't want to exhaust myself. So there was also some internal issues. You know, people would then, you know, everybody, you try to get people involved that you know. That's like the best thing to do, friends, family, to be part of it. But you start getting people that, you know, you've got certain groups of friends that you just keep separate otherwise, and you bring some of those people together for this, and heads are, you know, going to clash. You know, that's just what happens. And it happened in everything else that I've done in those 5 years since leaving that group as well. There was an incident that where I just had enough, and it was one of the investigators did something that was completely uncalled for while doing a case. I'm not going to name names. I'm not going to name a team or anything, because some of these people are still out there. They're not doing the ghost thing anymore, but technically speaking, the name is still around after all these years. And they don't really have a team anymore either. It's just the two. It's just the couple, so to speak. But they're doing something completely different. They're really not doing ghosts. And what they're doing is actually... I mean, if you think this whole thing's a joke, which it's not. It's October. It's not April 1st. And, you know, even if by the end of this episode you still don't believe and you think it's all hogwash or whatever, that's fine. You've got your beliefs, whatever. Maybe it has to do with religion. I don't know. But what they're doing now is complete bullshit. And I can tell you right now, from my standpoint of the paranormal and my views on things, it is complete idiocy what they're wasting their time and money on. But anyway, I digress. An incident had happened, and I never really liked this guy to begin with. In fact, this guy disappeared from the group until I came along, and I kind of took charge of some things within the group, and I try to really help, you know, get the gears going and put some new tires on the vehicle, so to speak. If let's refer it to that. I think that's a good analogy, and get this thing into gear and rolling, and made a website and started to, you know, make connections, if you will, the LinkedIn of the paranormal community. And as soon as the group got well known enough and well established enough to actually start getting calls on a regular basis, and we had all our equipment in check and we had a good team, this guy just came rolling right back in. Like, oh, you guys got some shit going on? Okay, I'm back in, and I'm, you know, kind of back in charge of some things. Cause he was kind of like in like this, like third in charge or something, I guess. And while he was gone, I was, I guess, third in charge, if you want to call that. You know, there's ranks. You got leads. That those were like a title: lead investigator, head investigator, you know, a equipment manager, and then just you had your I was gonna say patsies, but that would have been like Keith, because he was part of it for a while. Keith from Main Quest Podcast. You just had your regular investigators, and they would, like, you know, your leads and your managers and your heads, your founders, whatever, like, they were almost the staples. They went on every investigation. And then you had the other ones that, you know, it depended on how many hands you needed involved, in a case. And, you know, you grabbed, like, if you had like five other people on the team, you'd maybe grab like two or three of that five. And the next time around, you know, if you only needed two people, you'd grab the other two that didn't go, you know, and those are just investigators, field investigators or whatever. So, but this guy, like, he was just like, oh, yep, I'm kind of coming back after all this time being gone. Didn't come to meetings, nothing like that. All of a sudden he's like, yep, I'm back and I'm in charge. Like, and my friend that ran the group, he let it happen. And I'm just like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you just totally let him leapfrog over me, because I know, like, he was here like first, but he was barely here first. Like, he was barely, like, you guys did like two things and then he left. And then I showed up and helped you guys get someplace. And, I'm like, whatever, let's just all get along. We're all here for the same thing. That guy did something one night, during a case that was completely uncalled for. And he was almost proud of it. And I kind of think that the guy that ran the group was kind of going along with it until I said, that's bullshit. Like, that's... He went into a client's underwear drawer and put her panties up to his face. You don't do shit like that. That's fucking wrong on so many levels. And I tried to plead my case that with his history, and yeah, fine, he was there first, but he left and he comes back and he's got this Napoleon complex, and then you let him get away with this. And he admitted that it was wrong, but he had to let it slide. And I'm like, I'm done. I'm not going to keep going with this. I'm not going to keep doing this with him, and then also, like, by extension with you, who can't make, you know, an appropriate decision on what to do. So at that point, though, I was like a year deep, a year and a half maybe, like I said, and I was at this point where I was now looking for answers. I needed answers. I needed a holy grail of ghost moments. So I kept going with my own team. The problem with my own team is, and I wouldn't call it a problem, it actually wasn't a problem for a while, but aside from Keith, it was all strangers. Nobody knew anybody. I hired people, like a business. I hired people. Nobody knew anybody. And it took a fair amount of time for me to have these interviews, to talk to people, to weed through things. Like, I could almost sense, like, who was going to work out and who wasn't. And it worked. Like, everybody clicked. There was only one hiccup, really, that we had that was pretty bad, and that was we had one investigator that thought she could just bring her boyfriend into everything when he wasn't part of the team and wasn't trained. And there was actually one overnight investigation that we're going to do where kind of like everybody paid their way. There was like we had to pay because it was an overnight. We had to sleep in rooms. But I said, you have to turn these places like into a lab, you know, where you're doing a controlled experiment. Everything needs to be controlled. Everything needs to be accounted for. You need to know where things are, where people are, what they're doing, what's going on at all times. No outside interference. So she was told that he could not come. Like, we already had, all these people, and he was not to show up. Technically, we're investigating while sleeping as well, because the whole place was haunted. So some of us had recorders going overnight, and turns out when it was time for everybody to go to bed, she had him show up. And all of a sudden we woke up the next morning and he was there. And it's like, that was second to last straw. And then there ended up being, we had a meeting where there ended up being an argument, and I don't know what her problem was. And it turns out they never like stayed together anyway. He was kind of like this, he just seemed like a real loser, and she must have eventually like thought so too. I don't know what either of them saw in one another, but she was almost like with me, it was really, and at this point I was married, but like with me, it was like really weird. Like she, I went to talk to her, once, in that hotel investigation where we were staying in the rooms too. And which was in 2010, early 2010. We had been there very shortly, and everybody kind of was getting their things together in their rooms. And her door was like halfway open. I came just walking right in, and she wasn't dressed. And I'm like, oh, sorry. And I, turned around to walk back out. I'm like, your door was open. She's like, I ain't got nothing you haven't seen before or whatever. Like, she was like totally fine with being like nude in front of me or something. She wasn't completely nude, but pretty much almost there. And I was like, well, still like not comfortable. So, and I'm married. And so she was like really weird with me too. Like really weird. And the falling out that eventually where, I had her leave the group because we were having a meeting and, he was not supposed to come to this meeting, and she had him come. And when we were arguing, I almost got the sense that like she had something for me. And that maybe like her bringing her boyfriend was so that she wouldn't, I don't know, because there was times that we hung out like on the side to talk about, I kind of likened her to be like a lead, if you will. There was two people on that team that were leads. My brother actually was a lead as well. I almost found like he actually stuck with the last team a little bit longer, and I convinced him to like come over. I think something happened where, my memory is that there was a meeting with that last team, and there was like a snowstorm, and he had to drive 45 minutes to this meeting. And I thought, now this is my memory because I wasn't with the group, I thought there was something where that meeting with a snowstorm should have been canceled. Like, why would you make people drive to a meeting to talk about ghosts for 2 hours? Like, it's not that important. I would never have made my investigators go to a meeting in a snowstorm, and like he still like drove or whatever. But that was also like, he could have just said no, I guess. I don't know if he's listening. He would know better. I of course he can't just interject and let me know if I'm right or wrong. But I thought that was really like one of the nails in the coffin for him coming over to my group. Plus, I don't know that he knew it was as bad with my leaving until I told him. So I think like just things some at the end of his time with the last group kind of compiled, and he was like, yeah, I'm just going to go to my brother's group. There's probably less shit going on over there. So as far as drama goes. So this girl was kind of like considered a lead, and she was like one of the ones that was like really heavily invested, I felt like, in the group, and had some pretty good ideas, and we'd brainstorm things. But she was also like very like open, and she seemed like, and I, you know, I look back at it now, and I'm like, I think if I wasn't married, I think she probably would have tried something with me despite having a boyfriend. I don't know, but I'm going to shit you not. I was going to do like a reunion, investigation with the team. But there was a period of time where I was like ill, trying to figure out what the hell was going on with me. I was kind of sick and I was having problems with my memory and all this stuff. So I said, you know, we all got together, to play games and kind of have a meeting and talk about things and try to see maybe if the team could get back together after one investigation and maybe keep going after being done for, I don't know how long it was, 3-4 years. And so, guess who brought her new guy? So despite there being bad blood and some arguments and her and I fighting, and she was like completely making up shit, like, you're just jealous of my boyfriend and blah. I'm like, no, like, everybody here pretty much is in agreement with me. Like, he can't just be coming to these things. Like, he's not part of this. Like, we like tried to make him part of the team, but he's just was lazy, and like you could tell he didn't give a shit. So like, we didn't want him at this meeting. Like, this wasn't gonna work. And it wasn't a jealousy thing, like, at all. Like, I was married, and at the time, I was happily married. And, like, she was just completely defensive. And despite all that bullshit, I still remember that, like, it just happened yesterday, that argument outside the place we're having our meeting. And I'm like, you're nuts. Like, bye. You know, like, we don't need this. Aside from that, there weren't any other real issues, except for we had an investigation, the Villisca Axe Murder House, actually, one of our first investigations in 2011, in Villisca, Iowa. Look it up. An entire family and some acquaintances were butchered to death with an axe, and the killer was never found. One of my prized investigators, there was something came up. He must have had bipolar disorder, like, and I'm bipolar, but I'm not like that bad. Like, I think there's, I don't know, A and B. It's been so long since I've been diagnosed, and I was on medication in my early 20s that it actually messed me up. I felt like it messed me up more, and I'm okay without my medication, but I do have like bad days where I'm just like, I could be fine leaving the house or something, and then 2 hours later I come home and I just don't want to deal with the world, you know, like snap of a finger, or even like just going out for dinner or something. Like, dinner might start out fine, and then all of a sudden I'm a complete like depressed fuck you attitude to people, and I just don't want to talk. I want to just be by myself type of thing. It happens. It's not that bad. But he was like sometimes there are some days where like you could talk to this guy and he was like your best friend. And then there's other days where he seemed like his dog just died and he's telling you to fuck off. It was like really weird, like almost like me, but like a whole lot worse, like real emo, real emo. And so, yeah, after Villisca, the morning we were heading back, there was an issue, and it came out of nowhere. I don't even remember. I think it started at a gas station, and I don't remember what the hell started it, but I remember telling him, like, whoa, dude, like, where is this coming from? Like, what is your problem? Like, he had a problem with something I said or something that I did, something, the way something went down. Everything seemed fine up until the gas station. I have no clue what happened or where it came from. And then he was just like, I quit. And I'm like, wow, that's going to be, I mean, you're still going to be with the team for quite a few hours on the way back to Wisconsin. But yeah, he was just like, I quit. Like, I'm like, all right, well. And I tried, because I really liked the guy. My brother really liked the guy. He was a cool dude. And we tried to find him for the reunion and couldn't find him. Like, actually, when I was on Twitch, I did Twitch for a while in 2017, like about almost a year. He found me. I have no idea how, but he did. He just like popped in one day and we started talking, and then he just disappeared, like gone again. Like, that was it. The guy has zero social media presence, none. I think it was only like a few years ago or something that I'm like, I found his address or something. And I told Keith, I said, maybe we should just go knock on his door and just see what the fuck he's up to. Just be like, hey, we've been trying to find you for like forever, you know? And we found this address and thought, you know, I mean, he's there. And we just say that, like, we just want to hang out. We want to talk. We want to shoot the shit. I don't know. Never happened, but we really liked the guy. And just out of nowhere, he just did that. And I did have another investigator tell me that I am strong as far as my personality goes. And maybe that's just something that he personally had a problem with. And it's something that I worked on for about another year with this person in the group. She was pretty much a constant from beginning to end. She was like one of the original people that like stuck through the whole thing and was really 110% invested. And she tried to get me to, I don't know how long we did it for, through fall of 2012, when I said, okay, that's like it. Like, we're done. She tried. She was like, you burden yourself with too much. Like, you're running the group, you're managing all these people like it's a business. You're putting, you know, most of your money. There was something that we did. It was kind of like a kitty, if you will, where if we all were in agreement on some new piece of equipment, I would put in a majority of the amount of money into it, and then everybody else would pay in towards purchasing that piece of equipment. Like, you know, so if it was $100 piece of equipment, everybody would put in $5 and I'd put in the balance or something, you know, something like that. It was a good way for me to also know who was invested in what we were doing, what our mission was, what we were setting out to accomplish. And I was proud of that. And I was proud that people were turning around and putting in a little money here and there, and paying for, you know, our trips when we go out to other states, you know, some of these bigger places that you actually had to fork over money to investigate, like Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Louisville, the Axe Murder House in Villisca. You know, some of these places wanted money, and there's some people that are like, that's bullshit. Why would you pay to do something like that? You know what? It's a historical thing. I love nothing more than to see these places like still stand and get fixed up. And there's history there. And that's another part of why I did this. Like, I love history. I love the stories that go with some of these buildings that we investigated. Love it. Love it. And I am 110% fine with that money, quote unquote, being a donation, because that's what it is. They figured out a way to kill two birds with one stone. We can have people in here hunting ghosts and finding stuff and letting us know what they found. In the same time, we can preserve this place by having them pay to do that. And it's a win-win for both parties, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, so she, you know, she was like, you know, and you're putting in most of your money into this thing, and And then you're coming up with these game plans for the investigation, how rotations are going to work, where people are going to be, when they're going to be there, for how long, blah, blah, blah. Setting up a majority of the equipment, telling people where to go, giving them their marching orders for you know, any kind of equipment that they need to help set up. And like, she's like, you need to like, just maybe let me, you know, handle some of that stuff with you. And I was like, that was real hard for me to do. It didn't last that long. It was only like maybe two more investigations after I was just like, yeah, I'm going to relinquish some control over to her. Kind of like let her help be in charge of things. So it was tough, but there were some things towards the end. You know, the team had changed over the years. We still had our constants. And then we had some new faces coming in or whatever, but it still remained pretty much the same. And I was still kind of proud that there wasn't a whole lot of nothing like with the last team. There wasn't like a lot of drama at all. The two instances of drama, one which was clearly drama, was done with her, that girl and her boyfriend. And the other one was like, well, we don't know what happened with this guy. Like, where all this anger and angst and whatever came from that morning. Maybe something attached themselves from the house to him. Don't know. I wouldn't really call that drama. We never had drama with him before that. All of a sudden, he just was like, I quit. So, but that was it. There really wasn't a whole lot of other issues with my team throughout the years, and that's a good thing. But as the years went on, we started to get, you know, some good things. And I started to, I had instances throughout the years where I've heard disembodied voices in my own ears that I actually then captured also on audio. And that's when it's just audio and you don't hear it, it's called an EVP, electronic voice phenomena. And that's when you play something back and it's either something that's going to answer you when you're talking, or whether you're talking to it or you're just talking with another investigator, and it kind of just like says something and it like relates to what you're talking about. Like, well, it's probably intelligent. Sometimes you get some random shit, not so intelligent. But when you hear it with your own ears, it's just called a voice phenomena. So you're with your own ears and you capture it, voice phenomena. You know, we got those the most, obviously. And photographs of questionable things, lights or mists or whatever the case may be. You got to be quite, you know, very, very careful with those. I had things where I positioned myself in a room in a basement once, and I called something out, some kind of entity. This thing was not, it wasn't pleasant. It wasn't really malicious or anything like that either. It wasn't evil. In fact, I don't think I ever encountered anything evil or anything like that, but, it definitely was intelligent, and it definitely was there for some unknown reason, and it wasn't afraid to get involved with the living. And I kind of positioned myself in the dark to kind of like call this thing out, and I called it out, and it appeared, in front of me. This is probably, if I were to rank actual things that happened in my time doing this, this would be
one.
Just the fact that I was able to call upon something and it listened and it made itself visually appear in front of me. It then moved. Small room, small basement. It wasn't like a fucking hall or anything like that. But it moved from the corner of the basement, through me. And, to feel a ghost, touch you, go through you, is unlike anything you'll ever feel or experience in your life. I don't know. The closest I can always tell people is it makes you feel anxious. It makes you feel cold. Your hair stand up, like static electricity is going on. there's a very brief moment where you kind of like, for like a split second, you're like just blank. And then you're just with it. And then all of a sudden, like you catch your breath and you're like, holy shit. Like, then you jump up and you're like, guys, what? You won't believe this. You know, like, it actually went through a wall and it either went through another investigator or went in between the investigator. And actually my brother was back there too, or something. Like I don't think my brother, if I remember correctly, felt really anything. I think the other guy did, but mildly. They were more or less reacting. Their experience was more or less reacting to mine. So that happened. and then, you know, the other like holy grail, if you will, there's two holy grails really. And both of them, were captured, if you will, or happened on one of our very final investigations, actually in 2012. We had another investigation after it. And then, actually Keith and I, went out to Estes Park and did a ghost tour at the Stanley, but we kind of went as investigators, if you will. We kind of like, we're like, yeah, we're going to go on this tour, but we're going to kind of like try to also investigate without like really investigating. And I actually saw something there, but it's not that big of a deal. Like I actually left the group. I actually ran after it when I thought I saw it, and I chased after it down a hall, made a left, and whatever it was, it wasn't there. So I came back and I asked the tour guide some questions, and I think it might have been a ghost, but whatever. I like that there's still uncertainty around that. But we went to Ohio State Reformatory in Mansfield, Ohio. It's one of the last big investigations we did. The granddaddy, as I call them. I spent a lot of money on equipment for that one. Military grade IR lamps and a brand new shiny DVR system and an upgrade from what we had, and just miles of cords. It was huge. It was a huge undertaking, and it was very stressful for me, especially getting going and setting up. And I get a call because I'm basically sitting at what we call command or central or whatever you want to call it, where everything's just set up and you have to have people sitting there for hours. You rotate, but people sit there for hours at a time just watching monitors. So I'm sitting there making sure that everybody else all around this huge fucking prison, if you're not familiar, Shawshank Redemption, same prison. I think they're Disturbed or Godsmack or something shot a video there. So Google one of those two bands and Ohio State Reformatory and Mansfield Reformatory. They go by two different names. We did that one. And I'm sitting there and we got the walkie talkies going, and all of a sudden somebody be like, yeah, I'm down in, I don't know, Solitary trying to set up this camera and I can't get it to work or something. And it's like, so now I got to run all the way down to Solitary and leave the post while somebody else might be like calling and be like, yeah, I'm down in cell block, blah, blah, blah at the end. And I can't get this going. And it's like, oh my God, like, fuck. So it was a lot of stress setting stuff up. But in doing so, one of the areas that we were also setting up in was the main residence area, which is actually, if you watch Shawshank Redemption, like the offices and stuff, that was like, yeah, there was offices, but it was also where the warden and his wife lived. There was residences there as well. The actual prison itself was a set in a warehouse nearby. There was actually still prisoners at Ohio State when Shawshank was filmed. Now there's a whole new prison, actually like right in the backyard of Ohio State. So like if you walk out the back of Ohio State Reformatory, there's a certain line you do not cross, because if you cross that line and get anywhere near closer to the other prison, like there is a chance a tower guard might shoot you. So so that's a little bit of information for you right there. But the intake area wasn't really an intake area, but they used it as an intake area for the film. That was also inside the prison as well. But sitting up in the residence area, same place where all that stuff happened in the movie, Andy Dufresne's in the office playing his records. the warden's office with the safe in the wall, all that stuff is in there. In fact, even where Brooks, when Brooks in the film is released and he can't handle life outside the prison, he was reformed to prison life and he couldn't handle being a free man and he hung himself. That hotel room that he was boarded in was actually filmed inside the main office area of Ohio State. So I had to run out to do something, to help somebody or to get some people. I can't remember what the situation was. I had to leave the command area to go. The command area is the same area in Shawshank. It's a central location, in between, right in the middle of both the wings of the prison. The guard station, if you will. In the movie, it's where they're set up and they're eating. That's the actual area. So in the movie where they're eating at the tables is actually the central guard station area where most paranormal groups set up their main command area. So that's where we were. I had to run from that into the residences or the offices or whatever. On the way back, passed by some stairs on my left, almost getting to enter the prison area. And there was somebody standing on the fucking stairs. Like, so these stairs, they go up, there's a landing, and then you turn to the left and you go up another flight, and then you're on the next floor. It was somebody on the landing, just standing there. And the thing is they were on the landing enough where I could tell from like the waist down, there were no legs. And I'm like, this is exactly what I need to see. Like, I've been waiting for this at this point, like 4 years about doing this. It took that long to actually see something like that. So like when I saw things before, like the ghosts that moved through me, when I've seen things before, it wasn't like full body apparition type things where you can actually see details of like a man in the face and the clothes. Like, it was always weird. Always weird, like misty, like a blob, if you will, type of a thing. This was full-bodied. Well, half full-bodied apparition with no legs. And I didn't just, like, stare at it. Like, I didn't, like, stop and stare. Like, I blinked, and then I turned to whoever I was with, which might have been my brother and another guy, and I said, "Do you guys see him?" And then, like, as soon as I said that, like, I remember bolting up the stairs, because then I looked, I kind of, like, it was just a split second, but that's all it took for me to realize that he wasn't there anymore. So then I ran up the stairs, and it was like dark up there. I don't remember lights being on up there. I went as far as I could go, and all I had with me, I think, was my flashlight or my headlamp. I didn't have anything else. So, which kind of sucked. 4 years, and I finally saw something that actually was like an actual figure. You know what I'm saying? And I was like, this is going to be interesting. Like, the investigation hadn't even started yet. And it ended up being an interesting night. And despite all the problems that we started with, it was a good night. I remember I lost like 35 pounds to do that investigation, because it's huge. You got these cell blocks that are 5 tiers tall. And very long. It's a very huge place. Not the big Waverly Hills is pretty big too. And Waverly Hills, when you go, you start in the body chute, if you're familiar with that, you start in a body chute, and then we would go from the body chute to the first floor, and then we'd work our way up floors. So you'd like do an entire floor, and you go up some stairs, and then you go back the other way doing the second floor and so on and so forth. That was like 4 or 5 stories. But by the time we got to like the second to last floor, and the sun starting to come out, like, we were so tired. So, so tired. So I knew that going into another big one, I had to lose some weight. But as it turns out, I got the second Holy Grail, which was actual video evidence of a ghost. Not full-bodied. It was another vaporous apparition, a shadow, if you will. But I didn't know that I actually caught that, of course, until reviewing evidence. And we're just walking into a room, we're going to call it the administration building, where the offices and the residences were, the administration building. So we're walking through there, and I was actually with, I had a contest, held a contest back then. Had some contest winners, some investigators come along, and and I was with them, and just walking through, talking to them, talking to ghosts, trying to call things out, trying to get some EVPs, taking some pictures and some video. I had the camera, the video camera, and they were taking pictures. And they had, you know, I had the headlamp on. They didn't have any lights. They were just following me. And everything seemed normal. Nothing happened. But in reviewing the evidence, as we were walking through a doorway into a room, there is a shadow figure moving from the left to the right. And I was like, what the fuck? And I replay it and replay it. And then you show it to your other team. And then you got to sit there and you got to try to explain. Like, you got to try to explain. You need to have a mind like a steel trap. You got to remember every single thing that was going on in that room. You got to remember where people were, what equipment they had, who was, you know, doing what with that equipment. You got to keep in mind where things were positioned. You know, is there like a beam between the floor and the ceiling somewhere? You know, tables, chairs, lamps. Like, you got to like, you have to have a mind like a fucking steel trap doing this thing. And so you go through those just with your memory, possible scenarios. You're talking to other people in your team about it. And then once you figure that, okay, so there's nothing that could have caused this to happen. Now you try your best to try to recreate it. So, you know, if I was the only one with a lamp, I'm the only person that needs to be recreating this. You know, the other two people behind me that have no light source coming from them don't matter. And they're behind me. So the only other thing that could have caused it was a light source from behind me. And maybe that's my shadow as I'm walking and turning. That's moving from the left to the right or something like that. You know what I'm saying? So I only needed myself. I tried to recreate it in another room of equal size, going in from one door, though it was flipped. I think the room that I tried to do it in was mirrored, with a camera in my hand and my headlamp on, and I could not recreate it. You know, I can't travel back to Ohio to do it. So you can't travel back to anywhere to try to recreate anything. You try to do it as best as you can. Could not debunk it. Could not find a reasonable explanation for it. So only thing I could say is that it was a ghost.
That is the stupidest thing I ever heard of. Jesus Christ.
So, you know, that investigation took the cake. That was also a place that I felt like needed a redo on a little bit more of a stripped down level, because it started with so much bullshit. The other thing too is that investigation was also tainted because of drama between myself and some other investigators. So you try to also network with other people. There were some investigators from other teams that I networked well with that are good people. And then there was these people that were not good people. They kind of had the same type of complex that this other person had in the first group. They needed to be, they seemed humble and like we were all on the same level and all on the same page, but they kind of had these authority complex type issues. And they actually, even though this was it was supposed to be a joint investigation. It was the two groups. I mean, as we came up with special t-shirts for this investigation, both group names were supposed to be on them and everything. They wanted to do it their way with very little equipment. Like, I was bringing in thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars worth of equipment. They had some cool toys, I'm not going to lie. They had some cool stuff, but it wasn't anything to the extent of what I was bringing in. So I felt like with an 8-channel DVR system and these military-grade IR lamps and all the cameras, static, not static, EMF readers, everything that I was bringing to the table, this was going to be my setup. This was going to be how I wanted to run things. This is how I, you know, you want to call it an authority complex, that's fine. But they're bringing in like a few suitcases of handheld stuff. You're not going to dictate what to do with, you know, and you're only two people. I've got 8. So this is my call. This isn't your call. It's just not going to be your call. So you're coming with us, and I'm giving you the opportunity to come with us. Because 2 people can't go do this by themselves unless you are part of, you know, you had the option of renting it out exclusively, which is what I did, this place, or you can be part of a tour, like a night tour, and you're with other people. You can't be that expansive with equipment, and, you know, it's just a glorified tour where you're ghost hunting. That was their only other option if they ever wanted to do that place. 2 people cannot rent it out by themselves because you also have to have a minimum of people. So I was being gracious. I was letting them, because we had worked together already and everything was fine, I was letting them come with us, and, you know, they pay a little bit less to be able to investigate with people that they know and use all of our equipment and my team as backup. And I'm going to go ahead and put their names on our t-shirts, and everybody's going to have a good time. But no, they were like, we're doing this and we're doing that. And I'm like, no, that's not how this is going to work. So I told them, like, pretty close to going, I said, you guys aren't going. We don't want you there. So if you drive, I'm going to make sure you guys don't get in, because this is not going to go well. We don't need you there. So everybody in my group was really afraid. We were really afraid. Like, holy shit, what if they do show up though? I gave them their money back. Like, what if they show up? What if they come anyway to cause a problem? Because we all knew that they would come to cause an issue. So up until we were let into the locked gates, once we were in and those gates closed and they weren't there, we all breathed a big sigh of relief that they didn't actually come. So, and they tried to actually latch on to some other groups as well. In fact, then, because they kind of like, quote unquote, had their own team, if you will, but it was just them too. But they had their, like I said, they had their own name and everything. But it must have not worked out for them either. Like, I think they realized, because you keep tabs on what's going on around you in this field, in your region. You keep tabs on things. And so I realized that it didn't work out with them too in their own name. So they latched on to like 2 other groups. And when I say 2 and latched on, I mean, like, it seems like they went from one group to another pretty quickly, I think within 2 years, and then they just both disappeared. So I think they had, they must've had some issues. I think they were too pigheaded to be doing this. I don't know what their end game was, why they started doing it. I think he was like some kind of engineer of some sort. He liked like these gadgets and these toys and stuff. Like, he had the spirit box and all that. Like, he was good with that kind of shit. Yeah. But I don't think they had like a true end game. I don't think they were going into this for the right reasons. And I think that they probably clashed with everybody that they got involved with. But yeah. So, Ohio State Reformatory. That was like the creme de la creme. I could have stopped at that point. There was, like I said, there was one other investigation, and then there was the Stanley Hotel, if you will. But the other thing too, that I felt like this was it, was I didn't know how bad it was going to be. But when we did my ghost story, there was a few of us, myself, the other investigator who I said was with the team from the very beginning through the very end, and then my brother, we were all involved. But myself and the client actually flew out to Los Angeles to film the interview portion of the program. And then they had a guy come out, one guy with a pretty decent camera, come out, and then we had to do the recreation of the investigation. And that's where this gal and Keith got involved in the recreation. So, I didn't know how bad it was going to be. So you gotta figure at this point, you know, the ghost hunting shows have been on for a while. You can tell that like Ghost Adventures and that Zach Bagans is probably over exaggerating. Probably saying something's demonic or something's possessing him or taking him over, jumping at things and screaming and swearing when that type of shit just doesn't happen in reality. It just doesn't. And then Ghost Hunters had issues. There was Jacket Gate, a live episode where Grant's jacket got tugged and you could see like string or something on the back of it, if I remember correctly, that going down. And the fact that they would go live on these shows and they were prompted. Like, they weren't just investigating and then they go to a commercial and they come back and they were investigating the whole time. It's almost like they stopped because they had come back from a commercial and prematurely it would air footage of them getting into position to act like they were still investigating. And they're just not actually doing anything. Like, it was obviously now at that point, you could tell that this was scripted. You got to start questioning yourself, being in this field, that these people that you looked up to, especially the Ghost Hunters team, kind of being at the forefront, kind of making it mainstream. It's the ghost hunting on TV has been around since before that, but they really kind of made it mainstream. And you kind of looked up to them. And then you find out that they've been lying and how much of it are lies. I really enjoyed Ghost Hunters when it started. I really enjoyed that, you know, for every five episodes you watch, maybe three of them, they say, oh, nothing's going on here. We didn't find anything. And there's explanations for shit. And so you'd watch an hour of Ghost Hunters where nothing happens. And I enjoyed that, actually. I truly did. But then it gets to the point, and then you start adding all these other shows where every episode you see, something happens, they capture something, there's something is demonic, you need to call a priest, and like shit like that. It's like, come on. When I flew out to Los Angeles, and mind you, I had to sign over a lot of my footage and audio for the what I have deemed the House of Human Remains investigation. There was two investigations at a house in Germantown, Wisconsin, where some human remains were found in the woods behind the house. Part of my being sensitive, I was able to communicate with this entity in the house and determine conclusively that it was the ghost of the person who was once alive, who was found dead in the woods. And I was also able to determine, before DNA evidence could, who it was by questions, by role-playing scenarios. The guy was a kidnapper and a rapist and a woman abuser, and he was on the run to elude capture and from up north in Wisconsin. And I think his last name was Hop. I don't remember his first name. Dan Hop, something Hop. Can't remember anymore. But he was on the run, and apparently he had a relative in Germantown. So that's where they thought that he would have went. As it turns out, they believe, my understanding is, really some hunters may have accidentally shot him, but didn't know or something. I don't remember. I don't remember the details leading up to the discovery of the body. But he died of a shotgun blast. I don't think it was his own shotgun either. I don't think he killed himself. So that's the only tie that they had, was that, oh, it could be this guy, but nobody knows for sure. And it you know, at that point, it was taking years. There was no real sense of urgency for them to get the DNA evidence cleared, and which was being done in Texas, I think. And so we had a fair amount of time to figure out what was going on. And through some role-playing scenarios we would do to try to get an entity or entities to react to something familiar, doing something as small as using a trigger object to, like I said, role-playing. And so we role-played. Like, I was kidnapping and going to assault one of my investigators, and like, do you like this? Do you want to be involved in this? You want to get in on this? And blah, blah, blah. And we got positive reactions. So I, through everything, through these two investigations, I was able to say with utmost confidence that not only was it the ghost of the person that was dead in the woods, but it was this guy with the last name of Hop who was wanted and then killed or something down in these woods. And it was probably sometime in 2013, I'm guessing. I don't remember. 2011. That wasn't that far. It was probably like 2011 or 2012, where I just kept like months and months, like every few months, I would just check to see if there was any kind of positive identification, get with the police out there. Finally, it was, and it was him. It was the same guy. And I was just like, I knew it. Like, I Unsolved Mystery starring Paul. And I was able to solve it using paranormal techniques instead of DNA evidence. So I was pretty proud of that. And that was the story on my ghost story. When we were out there filming the question part of it, they had me say shit that wasn't true. They had me act like, oh, you need to like say that you were scared. And I was like, but I wasn't. No, you need to like just say that really shook me up. And I'd be like, but it didn't. They're like, no, you've got to say it. You've got to put some drama into this. I'm like, how much more dramatic does this have to be? This is a pretty big fucking deal. You know, like this case is a pretty big fucking deal. And so they had to, they still forced me to say stuff that this really shook me up line. They actually ran it twice in the interview portion of the program. And when it aired at the end of 2012, in December 2012, I saw just how bad it was. They were using photographs from the client, where the client claimed that there was ghosts in her front yard from some pictures she took of flooding. And it's clearly reflections of trees in the water, and they're not ghosts. She said they were like monsters or something. And they would like, in the show, they would outline these monsters, almost like alien monsters or something. And I'm like, oh my fucking God, I could not have this relate to me, because this is not good. Like right at the beginning, right away, this is not good. And then the butchered interview and using the lines twice. And even during the recreation, I think they had us recreate something that one thing that didn't actually happen. And then they were putting in EVPs that weren't ours. And I'm like, oh my God, like this is how it is. I cannot believe anything anymore of these paranormal shows that I see on TV. When I lived this was real. And now there's a show that's lying about it. They've got still the bare bones basics of my story. It's still a good story. I'm still telling some things that happened. There's just still some things that are airing that did happen, but they're adding shit that they're adding photographs that weren't mine. And they're adding EVPs that I don't know where the fuck they got them from. I don't know if they just made them, and then they're editing the interview. So it is like not like the interview that I gave. And I'm like, you know, and then they made her, and then they said something about her like leaving the house. Like she was forced to move. Well, she wasn't forced to move because it was haunted. She was forced to move for other reasons, but they made it seem like she was forced to move because it was haunted and that the ghost followed her, which didn't happen. And I'm like, this is not good. Like I quit. Like I'm done. I said, I got my Holy Grail in one investigation, like both Holy Grails, technically. I should just be done. Like I'm done. I can't like go out there and have like, if this team gets any bigger, then all of a sudden people are like, hi, I think I've seen you on TV or something like that. Like, because it was still like peaking, like paranormal stuff was peaking still at that time. Like I can't have this come back to me. Like I need to be done. And I was pretty much done. That was it. And then I did like a cryptid Sasquatch UFO thing once a few years later with the people from the first group. And I'm like, this is garbage. No, thank you. I kind of treated it as a joke the whole time we were out in these woods at like midnight. I'm sorry. But yeah, there's just crazy people out there. I mean, there was something we did in the woods one point. Some lady, there was all in these woods in Burlington. There was like a vortex, and you go through this vortex. It's almost like the multiverse, where you get Sasquatch, you get aliens, you get fairies, you get ghosts, and then like some weird shit like at the end of this like haunted woods tour. Oh my God. It was like, there's some things that go on in this field, or that did, that were complete bullshit. But I can tell you firsthand from my experiences, ghosts are real. I firmly believe ghosts are real. I've seen too much. I felt too much. I know too much. And being my age now, 44, you know, and having this shit happen for like 36 years of my life, and five of it actually going out and trying to get answers, like on a professional level for myself and for others, I can say with utmost certainty, shit's real. I'm not lying. Shit is real. So that is my story, and I'm sticking to it on this special episode of Retro Rankings Podcast, giving you some paranormal history of myself.
Complicated fellow, isn't he?
If you want to know a little bit more, you can actually go to my YouTube channel, Potation Rotation, and go all the way back to the videos that started it all early in 2020, right at the outset of COVID. And there's a couple of videos with Keith of Main Quest Podcast where we do a two-parter vlog discussing our stories in a little bit more detail, a little bit more in-depth, some things that happen case by case. You can also go to Google and type in Paul Gasper Milwaukee Paranormal, and you'll get a Wix website that's still up. I completely forgot about it. It was when I went independent, in the case that I would just go out and do something small, like an apartment or something by myself, or I could still work with other groups, which groups started to fold. After my group folded, most groups in the area started to fold. And there's just one left, really, that barely does anything either, really, to be honest with you. Yeah, I had some contacts between 2013 and 2017 through the website. Nothing big came of it, nothing more interesting to have to speak of. And then in 2017, I pretty much officially retired, but the website's still out there. And there's some links and some case information. If you want to go there, you'll actually kind of see some of the other names of people and teams that I actually did say I was going to name drop here, but they're out there. So there's that. So there's still a record. But as far as actual evidence floating around out there and stuff, that's just gone. All my evidence is gone. It's with me in my head and my heart. And only the few people that were on my adventure with me know that they ever existed. So that's going to do it. The next episode, also going to be a special Halloween episode. Really, 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 really Halloween related. I'm going to have a guest on. It's going to be TJ. Is going to join me, and we're going to rank our top 7 Halloween films, like literally the Halloween franchise, The Shape, Michael Myers, with Halloween Kills coming out right around the corner here. We're going to be talking about our favorite Halloween movies. So join us on that one, but that's going to do it. Little haunted history with Paranormal Paul today. I want to thank everybody for coming. More information, you can go to potationrotation.com. That's where you find the links for the YouTube channels. And in case you want to listen to the podcast there, the recent episode is always uploaded there as well. Want to shoot me an email? You got some paranormal stories? I'd actually really like to hear them. I'm always really interested in hearing. That's the thing. You can tell me a paranormal story and I'm not going to think you're crazy. Like if you're like ever like a, like think that somebody's going to, you're going to tell somebody a paranormal story, and like right away you're like, oh, you probably think I'm crazy. Like, I'm not going to be that guy. Seriously. So you want to give me a paranormal story, shoot me an email, potationrotation@gmail.com. I'd love to hear it, but that's going to do it. I want to thank everybody for joining me on the special episode today. Have a happy Halloween. Boo. See you guys next time.
You better call.